It's time for Security Now. Steve Gibson is here. We got a jam-packed show. Lots of security news. Yahoo hacked. 1 billion accounts lost. What did the Russians actually do to hack our elections? And why the Florida court says, no, you got to turn over your passcode as well as your fingerprint. It's all coming up next and a lot more on Security Now.
Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is Twit.
Bandwidth for Security Now is provided by CashFly at CACHEFLY.com. This is Security Now with Steve Gibson, episode 591, recorded Tuesday, December 20th, 2016. Law meets Internet. Security Now is brought to you by Tracker, a coin-sized tracking device that pairs with your smartphone and keeps you from losing your most valued possessions. Visit thetracker.com right now and enter the promo code SecurityNow to receive a free Tracker Bravo with any purchase. It's time for Security Now, the show where we cover your security and privacy online. The last episode, the last fresh episode of 2016 with this guy, Steve Gibson, the man in charge at GRC.com, our security guru. I think you have disciples, Steve. We follow Steve's way. I know I'm a disciple in the sense that when I see a weird security practice or something new, I always ask myself, what would Steven say?
What would the Gibsonian response be?
What would Gibson do? WWGD. I also, I think that you've helped me kind of be a better consumer of technology because of that, you know?
Well, so, thank you. I do know, for what it's worth, that I get a lot of really good feedback from people who, as you said, they'll see some news and send me a note to make sure that it's on my radar, and often say, you know, can't wait to hear what you think of this, because as we've seen,
exactly,
yeah, you know, as we've seen, these things are complicated. It's funny, I was just thinking an hour ago about the Windows Metafile issue.
Wow.
And you know, which was controversial because it was clear to me and to Mark Rusinovich when he looked at it that all it was an escape that would allow native code to be placed in the image. Now, and the problem is that people immediately go to how horrible that is from an exploitation standpoint. But it's important that it be put in context. Metafiles were created before networking. So this was a clever solution to what if the language of the interpreted metafile doesn't do something that we need? Oh, let's just let the metafile contain native code. We don't. Google does that with Chrome. That's, you know, NACL, their native library that allows them with a great deal of control to do the same thing. Anyway, so the point is that this stuff is not simple. And, you know me, I love figuring things out and living in complexity. I just jump in with both feet. So, and I've had the advantage of being here all along, watching this sort of all happen. So for me, it's a symbiotic relationship. I love being able to look at these things and explain them to our listeners. And I'm just glad that so many people appreciate it.
We do. We do indeed. I look forward to that. I've learned, you know, I have to say in general, Twit's more educational for me probably than almost anybody, because I'm here for all the shows.
And I do hear you using
all the time
some of the stuff that we've talked about here on the other podcast.
Absolutely.
where there's overlap. So this week I named this Law Meets Internet because the lead stories generally involve the struggle that I think is we're just seeing the beginning of you know, the internet becoming like really a thing. It's, you know, important now. And in fact, the first thing we need to talk about, at least somewhat, is this whole Russia hacking involvement, because, you know, we can't just ignore it.
I really want to talk to you about this.
We can't ignore it completely.
Yeah.
So,
yeah.
But so, I mean, it's clear that this is like the internet is really something. And so naturally, there's confusion about how to handle the intersection of what started off as pure technology with life, and, you know, the way civilized societies have figured out to do this. Well, I guess even tribal societies, they have their sets of laws too. So, you know, it's rules and regulations and do's and don'ts. And so we have a number of things there. We got, of course, the Russian hacking involvement in the U.S. We have to also talk about briefly, incredibly, it gets even worse for Yahoo. Who could have thought it could be worse than 500 million accounts breached? Well, yes, it can.
Yes.
Then we've got, speaking of legislation, we have some misguided anti-porn legislation that's been made in South Carolina, some troubling legislation in Australia, some legal confusion from the Florida appellate court that you were talking about on MacBreak Weekly, some good news finally on the patent scene from the U.S. Supreme Court. So those are all just sort of law things that happened in the last week. Some interesting problems with Linux desktop security. Four new problems that have just happened recently. And again, the press has drawn the wrong conclusion. It's like, oh my God, you know, Linux is no more secure than anything else. It's like, okay, slow down. Then also, why last week's Mac OS X update was important. Because of responsible disclosure, we only found out now what got fixed. And it was kind of scary. Then we have more news about the steganography malvertising attack that we discussed last week and what the actual mechanism is that it's using. Some news of forthcoming inter-vehicle communications, which the National Transportation Safety, whatever it is mandating for like right now it's proposed rules. Once it happens, it has a two model year cycle, and then any new vehicles need to be able to talk to each other. So we'll cover that in more detail. And something I thought would really interest you, Leo, that you'll probably want to talk to Scott about, is professional cameras are being called upon to provide native built-in encryption. Also, Let's Encrypt has an almost foreseeable yet still worrisome extension that we need to talk about. After all that, we've got some additional news, some errata, some miscellany. And then I answer the question, exactly how does that I really, really promise I'm not a robot checkbox.
Oh, good.
Non-CAPTCHA work.
I've wondered this all a long time, so that's good.
Yeah. So I think a great podcast.
Good show. Coming up, and the law meets the internet. But first, before we get going here, may I interrupt just briefly to talk about our fine sponsor today, and I'm talking about the Tracker. I'm a loser. I admit it. I'm a loser, baby. In the words of Beck, well, I mean, I lose my keys. I lose my remote controls. I'd lose my car if I didn't fortunately have kind of the Tesla shows up on my smartphone, but now my keys show up on my smartphone too. So do my bags, so do my remote controls, anything I've got a Tracker attached to. The Tracker is awesome. It's about a quarter sized anodized aluminum device that pairs to your smartphone, iOS or Android, or your iPad for that matter. And lets you know where your keys are if you leave them behind. The Tracker is so awesome. It's thin, it's light. It's light enough that, and small enough that you could put it on a pet. In fact, they also offer a waterproof little case you can put it into. So if the pet gets wet, the tracker keeps on going. Removable battery lasts about a year, but it's easy to replace. Bluetooth LE is the technology. You can even add laser engraved messages to your tracker, Bravo, because it is anodized aluminum, or they have this really nice UV LED printing that you can put. We have trackers with all of the show album art on them. It's a great way for the holidays to help loved ones keep track of their stuff you give them, by the way. They'd be a very good stocking stuffer. Tracker makes losing things a thing of the past. I'm going to tell you how you can get an additional tracker for free. Now, let me explain how it works. It's not GPS of the tracker. That would make it a lot bigger, heavier, and would really kill battery life. It's Bluetooth LE. Your phone has the GPS. You also have two-way separation alerts you can turn on if you wish, so that if your phone leaves the tracker behind and whatever it's attached to, your phone squeals. And if you leave your phone behind, which I actually do a lot, the tracker will go, hey, you left, it beeps at you. There's even a button on the tracker you can push that will make your phone make a very loud noise, makes it very quick and easy to find. And the tracker does something extra good. They have a crowd GPS network. They have sold so many trackers in since they started, what, about a year, 2 years ago? 2.5 million trackers out there. Every blue dot you see, those are trackers. And you can see Europe, North America, South America lit up. Now, here's why that's a good thing. If, let's say you leave your keys behind. As you know, with Bluetooth, it's got a range of 30 meters, about 100 feet. Now, that means once you get far enough away from your keys, you're not going to have an update to their location. Your phone will show the last place it saw it. Oh, but there's more. Because if somebody who is using the tracker walks by your keys and their app sees it, it'll update your app. So you can find your keys even if you're hundreds of miles away, thanks to the crowd network. Your phone could track up to 10 devices at once. It is actually, they have 3.5 million devices shipped now. What? Whoa. Whoa. So here's the deal. Go to thetracker.com and never lose your possessions again. Plus, just for you, if you use the promo code SECURITYNOW to receive a free Tracker Bravo with any purchase. Great holiday gift. Very affordable, too. The Tracker, thetracker.com. Never lose a thing again. Even you, Ozzy. I'll never lose you, Ozzy, because he's got the tracker around his neck. Thetracker.com, promo code security now. Steve Gibson, back to you, my friend.
Our picture of the week, I got a kick out of.
Yes.
I don't know where it came from, but I think everyone's probably heard that, like,
Facebook, but Facebook is loaded with this kind of quiz thing.
Oh, okay.
And this could easily be a Facebook quiz.
Well, so remember, what was it? I think
your porn name.
Yes, that's what I was going for. I think it was your childhood pet and the street you grew up on.
Yes.
Something like that.
Yes.
And which would make me Terry Overhill.
That's good. For an older porn star.
So, yeah. Well, and I would be, I guess.
Don't give out your – some of these could be used in security questions. But I know you're smart enough. You would never use anything factual in a security question.
Exactly.
But that could potentially be another reason why they put these quizzes up, right?
Well, okay. Well, and that, of course, is the point. So in that vein, this appears to be for the people who don't have video, this is – a form you fill out that says, what's your Star Wars name? And so they're apparently doing the same thing. It says, enter your social security number and mother's maiden name to find out.
Great.
and then I put a little caption out the bottom, courtesy of P.T. Barnum.
Yeah, there's never, of course, a sucker born every minute, right?
He was given attribution for that famous phrase. And so I looked at this and I thought, you know, none of our listeners – well, I mean, they would find this humorous.
They get it immediately.
I'm absolutely sure that, I mean, remember, Leo, I know that you have probably seen ugly cars driving around the street.
A few, yeah.
Okay, somebody bought that ugly car.
Yeah.
You know, there was something called the Thing once, and I actually saw them on the road.
Yeah.
Someone bought a Thing.
That was a Volkswagen.
Yes.
And they end up discontinuing it because if you got hit in the Thing, it was composed of a bunch of panels. All the panels would pop off. You'd be sitting there naked on the road in your chassis.
And so this is the lesson that we've also seen, like, unbelievable colors on cars. It's somebody
Christmas
either bought
sweaters.
That or they did that.
All you have to think is Christmas sweaters. Yeah. People wear those, right?
So, and somebody bought them.
Yep.
So, you know, it used to be on a hook. Now it's on them. So the point is that somebody is going to see this and go, oh, I can't. What's my Star Wars name?
What's my Star Wars name? I want to know.
What was? Let me look up my Social Security number and put that in, and my mother's maiden name. And wow. Anyway, yikes! Just got a kick out of that. Perfect photo of the week for us. Okay, so Russian election hacking. Now we're in a situation again where neither of us have any facts.
Right.
That is, you know, I'm not on the inside. I have no connections with the NSA or CIA or anything.
Or the 17 intelligence agencies, of which I can only name three.
Yeah, it's like 17.
17? Who are these
Clapper
people?
Clapper is still clapping around in there somewhere, too.
He's in charge of the old Schmeagle.
But there is something we could say, and that is that from the coverage that I have seen, it appears that, well, and in fact, there's another, just the news just broke today, and I may make it the subject for next, week after next podcast, the first podcast of 2017, and that's the a massive Russian organized ring was found doing fake advertising, generating, it's estimated, between $3 and $5 million per day in ad fraud. Anyway, the point is that in the sort of standing back from 10,000 feet, in general, I get the sense that Russia, for whatever reason, has been expending a great deal of effort on the cyber front, that is in all things cyber, attacks, penetrations, scams of all kinds. You know, we're often talking about .ru domains, and things are, you know, generally terminating back in Russia. And so, you know, and as I understand it, they don't have a super energetic economy. It's not producing, you know, like a lot, except for, I guess, some natural resource-based stuff. So it's also something that is perfect for that kind of an economy. That is, cyber is. Because it doesn't have a high entry cost. It scales well and so forth. So I guess as I'm listening to all of this coverage surrounding, you know, the did they, didn't they, what happened, what's this about, and also just all of the chomping at the bit that's going on. Everyone's just all in a big, you know, flutter. It's like, okay, we've been saying now for years on this podcast that everything is porous. That is, we have so much complexity has been added, and we're lagging years behind in finding bugs that are often years old, and that creates a moving window of opportunity. All of that says that the more you want to do something, the more opportunities you can find. That is, everywhere we look, we see attack surfaces that can be leveraged. You know, and apparently Podesta got his emails hacked by clicking on a phishing link, which, you know, got something installed in his machine, and then they were able to say, "Oh, thank you very much," and look around. So stuff we've been talking about for years is happening, but also, you know, there are, you know, many of these organizations have subcontractors, which may or may not be very good. Some of the stories we heard were that the FBI was, for example, notifying a subcontractor who did IT for the Democratic National Party for months that their machines had been penetrated. And the IT guy didn't even take it seriously. He was part-time, and he didn't think it was the FBI. He thought it was just a prank call. And I mean, so it's a combination of human error, human factors, and of course, ultimately, software errors are the same thing. They're extensions of human mistakes that well-intended and intending programmers make, which doesn't keep the software from working, but it does create opportunities for bad guys to get in. And so I guess my take is I'm not, you know, without any evidence, without any insider knowledge, except just if you just, you know, swept your arm across the last several years of this podcast, you would have to come to the conclusion that when somebody wants enough to get into something with the way things are today, as we wrap up 2016, it's possible from literally hook or crook, you can get in. And
especially a targeted attack where a spear phishing attack where they're going after a specific asset. That's very hard to defend against.
Correct. I would say it's beyond hard at this point. I would argue it's probably impossible. With everything we've seen, we keep seeing gifted hackers able to penetrate whatever they want. Pwn to own, every browser falls in the first hour. And it's like, ouch. And, you know, and mobile phones do too. And it's
presumed that a government attacker has access to all, you know, unlimited resources or virtually unlimited resources.
Yes. So if we imagine that Russia has decided by policy sometime in the past that the internet is the best thing that ever happened for enabling them as a society, as a nation state, to mess around with other countries, then you put compared to, for example, what the U.S. spends on military, you put relatively tiny cyber resources behind a concerted effort, and all of the evidence would suggest that they can pretty much do anything they want to if they try hard enough.
And it goes both ways. We're clear. I mean, why wouldn't we be doing exactly the same thing?
Right.
And there's a certain irony, and it's the CIA saying, well, the Russians subverted our election after they have – that agency specifically has subverted elections with all sorts of covert actions over the last, you know, five or six decades.
We were listening to Angela Merkel's phone.
Right.
She was a little annoyed.
That was the NSA, but the CIA guaranteed that we would win elections all over the world, and has for years. So you and I both are liberals and probably voted a little differently than the outcome. But I think it's a little overblown to blame Russia on the outcome of the election, or to say,
oh, I didn't say that.
No, I know you didn't say that. That's what's being said. And I'm kind of want to push back a little bit on that, not because I'm happy about the result of the election particularly, but just because it doesn't seem like, I mean, okay, getting into the DNC's email, if you said they got into the voting machines and changed the count, okay, but that doesn't seem to be what they're saying.
No. And, you know, relative to whether the election was altered, as we know, you can't prove a negative.
Right.
And so there's no way now, retrospectively.
Although, we just saw today reports that said there doesn't seem to have been any widespread voter fraud at all.
Right. And I was thinking more in terms of biasing the electorate, On the other hand, you would argue that our own FBI was a substantial influence in that, with the timing of of what, you know, Comey understood. I mean, I completely understood the position he was in.
That you could argue. Yeah.
He couldn't say nothing.
Yeah.
Or after the fact, he would have been blamed for not saying anything. Yeah, well, and
that,
vice
that,
versa.
That you could argue about. But I don't – I think it's – in a way, it's a disservice to point at the election results, because what I would far prefer to hear our intelligence services saying is, we have widespread evidence of Russian hacking and a variety of activities. We need to do something about that. When you tie it to the election results, it makes it a much more of a partisan issue that really doesn't – it's a disservice to the much larger issue.
Well,
but I don't think they want to talk about how much we're doing. So it's – I think they're reluctant to get into that larger issue, frankly.
Right. I think that's exactly true.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, I'm much worried, and we've talked about this before, worried about hacking the grid, for instance. It would be fairly trivial for a nation state to take our grid down. You know, I mean, I'm a lot more worried about that.
Anyway. UPS, baby, battery backup.
Yeah. Well, I'm not worried about my servers anyway.
Yeah. Anyway, that's really all I wanted to say. I didn't want to not discuss it ever, but I just wanted to say, I'm sure it's no surprise to any of our listeners that this kind of thing is possible. We know that for example, that from Edward Snowden's revelations, how much our own government, our intelligence services are doing. It was an eye opener. I mean, like all the project names. I mean, we had a field day for a year covering all of the disclosures that came out of that. And we also know that China is very active. We're very active. And we know in many other ways, Russia is very active. And it's not hard to be active. And there's also, you know, people in their basements are able to hack things too. So yeah, it's we have. I mean, what's interesting is that we're seeing as the internet intersects the real world, and I guess if nothing else, the outcome and the issue of the U.S. presidential election is about as real as it gets. Then suddenly people are saying, oh, wait a minute, this is really bad. It's like, yeah, okay, this has been going on for a long time, and it doesn't seem to have gotten on anyone else's radar in as significant a way as it finally has. So I just think this is all for the good, because as we know, security is hard, and you have to work at it if you want it, and there are some places you really need it. I would argue messaging, I mean, some people certainly need secure messaging. I don't have any particular need for it because I'm just, you know, arranging what time to meet friends for a meal. But still, so I guess my point is it's variable, and something like, you know, the more important things are, the more people want them to be secure. The problem is we don't currently have an infrastructure that guarantees that. And there's all the other lessons we see is that if we ever get there, it's going to take a while. And you and I, Leo, will have been long retired.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, let's get the intelligence agencies focused on what Russia is doing and maybe come up with ways to defend against that. That I'm all for. I'm all for.
There's no way.
But I think you make an excellent point. I would hate to. Should we be fatalistic about that then?
I think you could. Well, I mean, we could call it that, or we could call it realistic. I mean, look at the history.
Yeah.
The history says your light bulb could be attacking someone.
Right.
I mean, we're not making this up anymore.
Truthfully, if I were Russia, I would. I think that there would be much more damaging things you could do than what seems fairly minor, which is breaking into the Democratic National Committee and releasing its email. It seems like they could have done a lot worse had they really been strongly motivated.
Yeah.
Am I wrong?
This is the other problem is there's always a problem with attribution. And we're also not able to read people's minds. So, you know, like just recently, the question was, or what was in the news, was that Putin himself was directly involved. And, of course, no one will explain how they know that, but that's now what they're saying. Again, that stuff, I just sort of I listen to it. I think, OK, well, that's interesting. Maybe that's true. But it isn't anything that is actionable. And but what we do know is that everything has been built up in complexity on a fundamentally weak foundation. Lots of security intention, but complexity, as we've often said, is the enemy of security. And what's happened now is that the internet is becoming really important. And as we will be covering here in the next few stories, that, you know, now our legislators, which is like the tool that the bureaucracies use for trying to, you know, set limits and boundaries, that's now getting involved, which is always a little frightening. But first, we find out that more than 3 years ago, in August of 2013, more than 1 billion user accounts at Yahoo were hacked. And so, you know, this news comes out since our last podcast. And I think, okay, well, actually it was Wednesday of last week. And I think, okay, first of all, remember the old phrase, you know, fool me once, shame on you. Fool me twice, shame on me. If I refuse to learn from my mistakes, well, whose fault is that? Which is my way of asking, what security conscious person could possibly still be using Yahoo? That is, you know, they've been sending up mushroom clouds for, you know, every few months for the last year. And anybody who is concerned about security should be long since gone. And it's what's interesting is that even after 3 months ago, after in September, when they confessed to the 500 million accounts being hacked back in 2014, so that was only 2 years ago, they didn't force password resets and security question changes. Now they're doing so. What we've learned is that this most recent billion-plus account disclosure revealed sensitive user information, including names, telephone numbers, dates of birth, hashed passwords, and unencrypted password reset security questions. You know, speaking of Terry Overhill. So if anyone listening to this is still using a Yahoo email account, you have to ask why. And also, absolutely, the only thing you really have to do is make sure you're not sharing any of that information, your password reset security questions, your hashed password, which is who knows how 3+ years ago it was being hashed. It's hard to imagine it would have been secure, and make sure there's no overlap between that and any accounts you actually do care about. I can understand having a throwaway email account, but just, you know, be very careful with the way you use it. And unfortunately, we're also seeing ways that someone getting into an email account can escalate their attack through various other means. So, again, it's hard to believe anyone would still be there. What we hear in the coverage or read in the coverage is that, and here's the takeaway: Yahoo was ignoring the pleas from their security IT people for years, that they were deliberately giving – they were like, yeah, you know, fine. We don't want to inconvenience our users. So what's one of our other major mantras on this podcast is, you know, security and ease of use are always at odds with each other. And so this, so what we're seeing is the downstream consequence of a huge pub company with public-facing accounts, Yahoo Mail, that also has the policy of not doing what their security people are urging them to do for years because they don't want to ruffle any of the feathers of their users. So billions, billions of email accounts.
I always suspected it because we'd get all these calls on the radio show from people whose Yahoo's account has been hacked.
And
And it wasn't that they had bad passwords. I mean, it seems like they were very vulnerable. The other thing I would say is I would like to propose and hear what you think is one probably shouldn't delete one's Yahoo account because you don't want to let that give up that mail address, especially if you ever used it for password resets or anything, because Yahoo reassigns those addresses. You don't want somebody else to get your email address. You want to keep it, but just keep it dormant and kind of I would sanitize it of any personal information.
Yeah, and we covered this problem with Yahoo a couple years ago.
Yeah.
That whole issue of abandoning an account. I think what they were doing was if you had not logged in for some length of time, they would send you an email into that account, which of course you wouldn't see because you weren't ever bothering with it. But then they would unilaterally make that reavailable. They were recycling these long dormant email accounts, and they got a big slap on their hand for that because so many people were using their Yahoo Mail as recovery for other things. So that was my point about how, unfortunately, our experiences online are interlinked. So you might have registered once your Yahoo Mail as your backup email for recovery of something that you do care about. And if a bad guy then got a hold of your Yahoo Mail, they could, I mean, exactly as designed, use their control of your backup password recovery mechanism on an unrelated service to gain access to that service. So yeah. So I remember when we discussed it before, the notion was, well, you know, how do we remember to log in every quarter? Just, you know, say, hi, Yahoo, don't expire this account. I used it once and I don't ever want anybody else to have it. You know, wow. And it's very much like the problem of a domain name that gets lost.
Yeah.
And then, you know, squatters sit on it because there's going to be some traffic that's going to wander in and, you know, get exposed to what's there.
Yeah.
South Carolina legislation has been proposed by Bill Chumley, a state representative, Bill Chumley. He has filed a bill to require computer sellers to install digital blocking capabilities on computers and other devices that access the internet to prevent the viewing of what the bill says, obscene content.
What?
Yes. yes. The proposal... The proposal would also prohibit access to any online hub that facilitates prostitution and would require manufacturers or sellers to block any websites that facilitate trafficking. So he's saying if you're going to sell computers into South Carolina, our citizens must be protected. But now here's where it starts to get sort of strange. Both sellers and buyers can get around the limitation for a fee. The bill would fine manufacturers that sell a device without the blocking system, but they could opt out by paying $20 per device sold. And even more oddly, buyers.
Who gets the $20?
Well, and here we go. That's exactly the right question, which is why I think this whole thing seems a little fishy. Now, wait, we're about to get there. Buyers could verify their age and pay $20 to remove the filter. It's like, okay, what?
Huh?
The money collected would go toward the Attorney General's Office Human Trafficking Task Force.
This is just goofy. Whoever this guy is, it's not. If it passed, then we should talk about it. But this guy's a crackpot.
Chumley's bill has been referred to the House Judiciary Committee.
Yeah, where they're going to bury it.
And so my comment was the weird quote, adults may pay $20 and have the filter removed, gives the legislation more the character of a fundraising extortion racket for the Human Trafficking Task Force, which, I mean, that's a great task force, but still, it's like, you know, what? Yeah. So anyway, this just popped on the radar, and I thought, okay, this is too crazy.
This is a mishmash.
And as you said, Leo, until a gavel drops, it's just, you know, we've seen lots of legislation come and go that never got anything.
Well, but to be fair, there is, you know, they have filters in the UK. They have, I think they have filters in Australia that are mandated.
That's our next story, actually.
Okay, go right ahead. I don't mean to slow you down.
Meanwhile, an Australian court ruled on Thursday, December 15th, last week, that the Pirate Bay and a collection of other sites must be blocked by internet service providers. I have in the link of the show notes. Oh, I should mention, show notes are already online for anyone who wants to follow any links there. So I'm now working to have them always at on the Security Now page, grc.com/SN. The first item there is this week's podcast, and I will continue to try to get them up immediately. So the measures have not been implemented yet, but this just happened on the 15th. ISPs have 15 days. That is, by year's end, by New Year's, internet users will be blocked by default by ISPs. Now, what's interesting is that Google's data shows a large surge in searches for the acronym or the abbreviation VPN, and VPN services have reported a significant increase in interest from Australia. Justice John Nicholas of the Australian Federal Court has ordered Australian ISPs to block the Pirate Bay, Torrents, Torrent Hound, ISO Hunt, and Solar Movie, and many proxy and mirror services of those that, as the coverage says, marks the start of a mass internet censorship down under. And we're not surprised to find that this is the result of a case brought by Roadshow Films, Foxtel, Disney, Paramount, Columbia, and 20th Century Fox. So, you know, stakeholders in copyrighted material are saying, you know, we want access shut down to these sites that exist purely for the sake of piracy. And more than 50 ISPs are now required to start barring subscriber access to these sites. There's also I did not go into the details of the legislation, but it's been in the works for quite a while. And since it began, Torrents, Torrent Hound and Solar Movie have already shut themselves down, but the judgment continues to name them in case they might return. And the ISPs are given some latitude about how to actually perform the blocking. They could use DNS, so like intercept and remove those from DNS services available in Australia, so you just can't get the IP addresses, or block the physical IP addresses as they try to exit from Australia, or also filter and block on the URLs, or any alternative means which are approved by this coalition of copyright holders. And this is a little worrisome now, too, because this legislation essentially puts this group of copyright holders into the loop, like permanently in the loop for like, it, can we block them this way? Is this okay? And there's apparently a $50 charge to the copyright holders per blocked site. So it's not free for them to keep adding them, but there is a mechanism also for them to routinely go back and say, okay, and now we want you to block this, 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 and this, and this. So, wow, it just seems like a very slippery slope.
And a template for what's going to happen here in the next year, I would predict.
You really think so?
Yeah.
Yeah, wow.
Well, I'm sure the Motion Picture Association
will be pushing.
Will be pushing hard, yeah.
Yeah, who was it? It was a leading Democrat who went to work for the MPAA. I can't remember his name now. I was disappointed.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's a it's sad. I mean, we have a mess. It's a revolving door.
Yeah, and again, here again is real world meets internet. And unfortunately, this is an attempt to apply controls that the internet was not designed to provide. We were, you know, in the early days of innocence, we were all celebrating freedom of expression and the openness and how it was uncensorable and all that. And it's like, well, you know, it isn't designed with any of those things in it, but you can do things like filter. And the problem, of course, is VPNs. If you're allowed to run a VPN tunnel outside of Australia, then that bypasses any border protection. Just bang. So no wonder searches for VPNs are on the upswing.
By the way, it's Chris Dodd, the chat room says.
Chris Dodd. Yep, that's exactly who I was trying to
think of. The thing that really worries me is you get then this escalating battle between the people who want to filter government at the behest of the copyright holders and users. And it really is bad in general. You know, then VPNs get blocked, right? And then, I mean, ultimately, it ends up being not just bad for people who want to steal movies. It's terrible for everybody.
Well, and as we've talked about, there's a real problem with false positives.
Right.
I often hang out next to a Verizon that has free open Wi-Fi. And so and it's great Wi-Fi, so it's there. So I'm not doing anything trying to hide. So I'll use their Wi-Fi. And sometimes, because I'm also researching medical stuff, I'll get a block page. And it's like, what? You know, I mean, because of course there's some overlap, but you know, maybe the page mentions testosterone or something. Who knows what? But I mean, you know, but for whatever reason, this is like, you know, it's PubMed. It's you know, our government's medical research archive, and Verizon's NannyGate isn't letting me see a page because it's like, oh, no, you know, can't get there. It's like, oh, okay. So unfortunately, as we know, it's an imprecise technology, and even the definition. You know, who was the judge who famously said, well, I can't define pornography, but I know it when I see it. It's like, well, okay, well, that. How do you write a law around that?
Mm.
Yeah.
What the problem is that
I'm not for stealing things, but the and so I you know, and that's one of the things laws and government do is they punish thieves, and that's an appropriate thing. I don't want somebody to come into my house and steal my stuff either. But the problem is the people who are making these laws are generally, in fact, entirely ignorant of the how the technology works, the technological issues, and the long-term consequences of the things they ask for. And that's what worries me more is the ignorance among lawmakers.
That and that we have a history now of the copyright holders being very overreaching. As we've often quoted on this podcast, they tried to prevent home videotape recording under the argument that it was purely for piracy. That's the only reason anybody would want that was piracy. Fortunately, that didn't happen, and we're able to record content for our own consumption at home. But against the desires of the media providers. And of course, we went through the same thing with the DVD that was all, you know, ridiculously encrypted, which lasted all of a week or two because you can't do that. You know, there's just no way to do that securely. But again, a huge amount of effort was put in, and it just ended up inconveniencing everyone and producing no effective result.
I said 10 years ago that ultimately the ultimate freedom fighters would end up being hackers. People who know how to use technology and can protect our freedom online. So everybody needs to start learning this stuff now. If you want to preserve freedom, learn technology.
Yeah.
Otherwise, it's used against you.
So we've often spoken of the difference between something you know and something you have relative to recent court decisions, and I heard you talking about this on MacBreak Weekly just now, Leo, and our listeners need to hear it too, because there was a recent decision was reversed on appeal in Florida, which changes, I mean, depending on how this goes, you know, like what future this has, this argues that unlike what had been believed up until now, that a suspect who is blocking the acquisition of evidence by not divulging something they know, their passcode, up until now, as we've discussed often, that was regarded as testimonial. And so the Fifth Amendment to the Constitution, which protects against self-incrimination, was protection. That is, you could not compel testimony against oneself thanks to this Fifth Amendment. So last Tuesday, a Florida appeals court ruled in a case of a man suspected of voyeurism that police may lawfully compel the disclosure of a mobile device's passcode for the purpose of searching it for incriminating evidence. Okay, so a little bit of context here. The guy's a creep. No one's on his side. His name is Aaron Stahl. He was arrested after a woman who was shopping in a store saw him crouch down and extend an illuminated cell phone under her skirt, according to court records. When she confronted him, Stahl told her that he had dropped his phone. He ran out of the store when she yelled for help, but police were able to identify him using his car's license plate number as he made his getaway. He was later arrested for something known as third-degree voyeurism. Sounds like first degree to me, but I don't know what the degrees are. Sure does seem premeditated, if nothing else. In a police interview, Stahl initially gave verbal consent to a search of his cell phone. So I said, will you let us search your cell phone? He said, yeah, okay, which was an Apple iPhone 5, but subsequently withdrew his consent before telling the police his four-digit passcode. Once police obtained a warrant for the phone, they were unable to access the photos on the phone. okay, again, no one's on this creep's side. We're on the side of civil liberties, and this the question of does the Fifth Amendment still apply? So there's some what I described in my notes as tortured logic. There's some rather tortured logic at this. So at trial, the judge denied the state's motion to compel Stahl to give up his passcode, finding that it would be tantamount to forcing him to testify against himself in violation of the Fifth Amendment. But subsequently, the Florida Court of Appeals, Second District, reversed that decision. Actually, it was last Wednesday, finding that the passcode is not – this is what's strange, the wording of this, but I was careful to get it. The passcode is not related to any criminal photos or videos found on the phone, okay? Meaning that – so somehow the fact that you need the passcode to divulge them, a three-panel judge disconnected those. So Judge Anthony Black, writing for this three-panel judge, said, providing the passcode does not, quote, betray any knowledge Stahl may have about the circumstances of the offenses.
This is about the right to not self-incriminate. They're saying giving the passcode is not self-incriminating.
Right, right, exactly. It's not like divulging the photos themselves.
Right, that would be incriminating yourself. Give us your photos. You have the right to say no.
So they have a search warrant they cannot execute because he's blocking it.
Right.
So the text goes on to say, thus, compelling a subject to make a non-factual statement that facilitates the production of evidence for which the state has otherwise obtained a warrant based upon evidence independent of the accused statements linking the accused to the crime does not offend the privilege. In other words, they assert that a passcode is not testimonial, it's surrender. So you're compelling a person to surrender something, not to testify. And of course, as we know, it was the Supreme Court decision back in 88, Doe versus the U.S., where Justice John Paul Stevens wrote something that we've often repeated, and you mentioned in the previous podcast, Leo, that a person may be forced to surrender a key to a strongbox containing incriminating documents, but cannot be compelled to reveal the combination to his wall safe. So what we have now is an appellate court essentially reversing that U.S. Supreme, that standing U.S. Supreme Court decision. Okay. So I guess maybe this will go back up to a higher court. Maybe they'll just I don't know what the mechanism is. If the U.S. Supreme Court says we've already ruled on this, does the appellate court decision stand? I don't know. Anyway, we'll keep an eye on it because, you know, this has been an interesting point for people to say, oh, no, you don't want to use your thumbprint. You want to use a passcode because that's something you know, not something that you can be compelled to produce. And, you know, you be held down and put your thumb on the phone. No one can make you tell them you know, but you can be held in contempt of court. I'm sure you would be, and then, you know, jailed until you surrender the information.
Yeah, and as we pointed out, I mean, the issue isn't so much the passcode, is that you don't want to let the government pluck things from your brain because that it kind of encourages torture or compelled or forced confessions. And so that's I'm no lawyer, but I would guess that that's the reason for the Fifth Amendment. And that's what the Supreme Court would have to decide. I don't think it's obvious what the right answer is, by the way. I can understand the case on the other side as well.
Yeah.
It's very interesting.
We do have some good news. Thanks to our friends at the EFF, the U.S. Supreme Court has agreed to hear a case that could end the famous Texas grip on patent cases. In the case TC Heartland versus Kraft Foods, that case effectively asks the court to decide whether patent owners, which as we know are unfortunately all too often not patent users, they are patent trolls that collect patents purely for prosecutorial purpose in order to squeeze money out of people, much like the podcast patent that was hanging over Twit's head for a while.
And would have gone to Tyler, Texas.
Yep. To decide whether patent owners can sue in practically any corner of the country. The EFF supported the position and side of TC Heartland, who is the petitioner, at the Court of Appeals for the Federal Circuit, as well in asking the Supreme Court to hear the case. The petition to the Supreme Court became necessary after this Federal Circuit issued a disappointing decision that maintained the status quo. So it's like, okay, we need to escalate this. And the good news is the Supreme Court has said, we agree, bring it in front of us. The current law, as it is now, and was unfortunately just recently re-upheld, allows patent owners to pick and choose between federal courts, often opting for courts that are perceived to have rules and procedures favorable to their position. The result, writes the EFF, has been astounding. Last year, almost half, 45% of all cases were filed in a single Eastern District of Texas, a rural part of the country that has no major technology industry, just a well-fed judge.
Well, it's not even that, because what you want is a jury that is well disposed to protect the little guy, which is how these non-practicing entities position themselves. Where I invented something, and now the big company came along and took it from me. So you don't want people who work for big companies,
right? And we've talked about this in the past. There is a stadium in that town that Samsung fully supports. They've got like Samsung banners and flyers, and
they're trying to win hearts and minds.
Exactly. They're saying, we're good. Please, think of us in a good light, because they recognize they're vulnerable. They've just been raked over the coals by this ridiculous county.
So when I can now talk about this, because during this, we did, of course, get approached by the podcast troll. And that patent was invalidated by the patent office, so the whole issue is over, thank goodness. And they did go after, as you know, Corolla, and Adam Corolla fought it. Good for him. We would have fought it as well. I would not. They asked for $2.5 million, I think, something like that, and we just laughed. And we would have fought it, but they didn't end up coming around to suing us. But what we did do is engage an attorney who practiced in East Texas, who had done patent cases in Tyler, Texas, who knew the judge, because there is one judge who's the one everybody wants, and this is where it would have been. This is the jurisdiction it would have been tried in.
And he's busy.
He's very busy. But again, it's positioned as, no, we're trying to defend the rights of the little guy. The guy who invented intermittent windshield wipers against the big bad corporation stealing his idea. And that's something juries really eat up. So what our strategy, we had several meetings with our attorneys, and our strategy would have been to go down there, have a barbecue, have all the churches that have podcasts, have all the little podcasts from that area come and meet people and bring our viewers down. Because the idea would be to say, we're not the big guy. We're like you. And podcasting is how normal people get a voice in the world. And I think that would have been actually a good strategy, but we never got to exercise it.
Well, so. And there's so much wrong with the system, because, for example, none of the money spent is recoverable.
Right.
It's all just gone.
Right. It goes to the attorneys, but that's the point.
Yeah, exactly.
It doesn't go to the – usually the patent – the guy who came up with the patent has sold that long ago to these non-practicing entities.
Right. Right. So anyway, the EFF concludes saying, we're glad to see that the Supreme Court – has agreed to hear this important case that could significantly curtail some of the worst actors in the patent game. EFF will be there to urge the court to restore balance and fairness in patent litigation. And I say again, for the umpteenth time, yay to the EFF.
The podcast patent overturned. We were thinking of, and we had decided not to do this because it's risky, they had decided to pursue what's called a intra partes appeal to the patent office. And the reason it's risky is if the patent office affirms the patent, of course, that goes right in front of the jury. Look at this. These guys tried to get the patent overturned, and the patent office came back again and said it's a good patent. So we didn't want to do it, but the EFF decided it was a good thing. They had prior art and so forth, and so they felt like they had a good shot at it. I donated money. A lot of people donated money to the EFF to pursue this, and they won. And that really eliminated the whole thing. They got the patent overturned, and they won. But it's why I also continue to donate every month to the EFF, and I think everybody should. It's a great organization.
Well, and I think I've mentioned before that the last time I ever agreed to serve as an expert witness was in a suit between Princeton Graphics Systems and NEC over the multisync, which Princeton Graphics alleged was infringing on their patent, and NEC was fraudulently making claims that were unsubstantiated. And so I thought, this sounds interesting. And so I said, I agreed with NEC's position. So I let them hire me and explain to the judge, you know, as I do, so clearly, so carefully, so that, you know, the fly on the wall understood like what was going on here with its two neurons. They've been synchronized, and the decision came down the wrong way. And I thought, okay, you know, I'm not here to make money. I'm here to help the good guys. Yeah. And it didn't work. So I thought, screw this. I'm not doing this anymore. Okay. So on the topic of everything is porous, Linux is in the crosshairs. A neat security researcher, Chris Evans, who we've spoken of before. I'm not sure if he's employed by Google or affiliated. He does on his site refer to his buddy Tavis Ormandy, and of course we know Tavis well of Google. Chris has been playing recently with the GStreamer. Okay, are you sitting down, Leo?
Yes.
Media library. And we know what a problem Android had with its media library. Turns out GStreamer is the de facto media processing pipeline, which is open source, multi-platform, present in most Linux distros by default, and makes stage fright look like a good thing. So this is just the beginning of taking a look at it. So about a little over a month ago, November 15th, Chris posted on, he has I read my own notes, a blog called Scary Beasts. So it's scarybeastsecurity.blogspot.com. And so his posting on middle of November was, and he had the tags 0 day and proof of concept, POC. He said, risky design decisions in Google Chrome and Fedora desktop enable drive-by downloads, meaning you just visit a web page and in the background, if you visit it with Chrome, Google's Chrome browser, on Fedora, it downloads files. And I think it runs them. So his overview says, a confluence of risky design choices combined with various implementation issues makes drive-by downloads possible with Google Chrome on Fedora. First, Chrome will automatically download files to a user's desktop with no confirmation. Oops. Fedora's tracker software will auto-crawl downloaded files to index them, including media files. Three, the GStreamer framework, as used to handle media in the Fedora desktop, has questionable, he writes, and then in the next two blog postings, we're going to learn just how much that is true, implementation quality from a security perspective. Four, the tracker component responsible for parsing media files does not appear to be sandboxed, as in, for example, with security enhanced Linux, SE Linux. And finally, the Fedora default desktop install includes a range of fairly obscure media decoders that confer risk but are not necessary for a thorough desktop experience, which is Chris's polite way of saying there's a bunch of crap in there installed by default that few, if any, people will need, but which expands the attack surface needlessly and dramatically. So basically, he goes into great detail afterwards, but that's the gist of this. So a drive-by file download vulnerability, and it's not sandboxed, and apparently this tracker indexing then allows you to leverage problems with GStreamer in order to essentially execute content on the system in the security context of GStreamer and or tracker. Not good. A week later, Chris is back on the 21st of November with this one's tagged Zero Day and Exploit. And he says, advanced exploitation, a scriptless zero-day exploit against Linux desktops. And then in his overview, he says, a powerful heap corruption vulnerability exists in the GStream decoder for the FLIC, F-L-I-C, file format. Presented here, he writes, is a zero-day exploit for this vulnerability. This decoder, this FLIC decoder, is generally present in the default install of modern Linux desktops, including Ubuntu 16.04 and Fedora 24. GStreamer classifies its decoders as good, bad, or ugly. Despite being quite buggy and not being a format at all necessary for a modern desktop, the FLIC decoder is classified as good, almost guaranteeing its presence in default Linux installs, thanks to solid ASLR/DEP, that's, you know, as we know, address space layout randomization and data execution protections, on some modern 64-bit Linux installs, and some other challenges, this vulnerability, he writes, is a real beast to exploit. But that doesn't stop Chris. Most modern exploits defeat protections, he's writing, such as ASLR and DEP, by using some form of scripting to manipulate the environment and make dynamic decisions and calculations to move the exploit forward. In a browser, that script is JavaScript. Or he says, or ActionScript, in the case of Flash. When attacking a kernel from user space, the script is the user space program. When attacking a TCP stack remotely, the script, in quotes, is the program running on the attacker's computer that is remotely over TCP. As in my previous full GStreamer exploit, and this was something I didn't cover because it wasn't quite as on point, against the NSF decoder, the script was an embedded 6502 machine code programming. What? This was some This was what? Well, it's because that was the chip in the Nintendo something or other. And so they were emulating, in order to run Nintendo stuff, they were emulating the 6502 famous processor technology chip. And there was, and so he was able to abuse the 6502 interpreter in order to leverage an attack. And he says, but in order to attack the FLIC decoder, there simply isn't any scripting opportunity. The attacker gets once to submit a bunch of scriptless bytes into the decoder and try to gain code execution without further interaction. And he writes, and good luck with that. Welcome to the world of scriptless exploitation in an ASLR environment. Let's give it our best shot, which is the beginning of a post where he shows how he did it. And, you know, this is somebody you want on your side. This guy has, and he looks like he's about, now I don't mean this in any negative way, Chris, but it looks like he's about 12. Uh-huh. So it's like, who, if he's not already working for Google, everybody should go try to hire this guy, because he's got some serious skills. So what all that means essentially is that he figured out how to feed the FLIC decoder interpreter essentially a program which was complex and would do what he needed it to do by writing code in this metafile that the FLIC interpreter is going to interpret in order to get it to do this work. And it's like, okay, wow. I mean, so here's a classic example of if you want something bad enough, our current systems are replete with opportunity. You know, most people can't do that. Somebody good enough. I mean, there's other lower hanging fruit. Probably Chris is bored by low hanging fruit. You know, he wants to get a trampoline with stilts, and you know, in order to reach up high enough, in order to pluck this thing. But major skills. And finally, this brings us to last Tuesday, a week ago, when he posted most recently apparently he'd been involved. He'd been working on this Super Nintendo thing for a while. So, all I did is have his little quick TLDR, which is a full reliable 0-day drive-by exploit against Fedora 25 and Google Chrome by breaking out of Super Nintendo Entertainment System emulation via cascading side effects from a subtle and interesting emulation errors. And then he says, very full details follow. So again, I have links to all of Chris's blog postings. If anyone is interested in the mechanics of this kind of serious roll up your sleeves reverse engineering, this is the guy to go read. And he, you know, you might want to just follow his blog, because he posts every, you know, his latest exploits and exploitations at scarybeastsecurity.blogspot.com.
Now they said in the chat room that these exploits were patched before they became public, or is that not the case?
You know, I didn't follow up.
Okay.
And find out. I would be surprised if not, because Chris is nothing if not responsible.
Yeah,
so
yeah.
I'm sure that's, but again, you know, these were there until Chris found them.
Right.
And
but this is why open source works. I just want to point out, you know, people go, oh, this is a terrible thing. Well, But this is why it works. If it gets patched right, you know, then this is all good, yeah. Right?
Because it doesn't work any better than closed source. It's all the same, Leo.
I guess.
This is all, you know.
You can at least look at the code and look for flaws in the code.
But that, I mean, that also allows you to look for exploits in the code. So, yeah. I mean, it's a double-edged sword.
Yeah, I guess. Yeah.
Yeah. No, I mean, and that's what people do. They go over the code to find it. And so, for example, when Microsoft releases updates, people have to reverse engineer
the
patch in order to figure it out. No, there's no reverse engineering needed here. You just look at the open source. I mean, so, I mean, I think.
By the way, GStreamer, I think, is not open source, come to think of it. I think it's proprietary. No, is it non-free?
I looked on Wikipedia. They've got a full. It's got a full Wikipedia page. I think it's completely open, but I'm not sure. I know it's multi-platform.
Yeah.
And I did mention four vulnerabilities. Those are three. And this is just quick. There's another researcher who knows Chris recently posted his, which is and I guess Chris is probably a Fedora user, so that's why his exploits tend to be Fedora based or aiming, not that other distros wouldn't have the same problem. He says his was reliably compromising Ubuntu desktops by attacking the crash reporter. And he just writes, in this post, I'll describe how I found a remote code execution bug in Ubuntu desktop, which affects all default installations. From Quantal on, the bug allows for reliable code injection when a user simply opens a malicious file. Okay, so the user has to take action. The following video demonstrates the exploit opening the GNOME calculator. The executed payload also replaces the exploit file with a decoy zip to cover its tracks. Full source code for this exploit is available on GitHub. And he says, this research was inspired by Chris Evans' great work on exploiting client-side file format parsing bugs in the GStreamer library, the GStreamer media library on Ubuntu. We will look forward to other default file handlers on Ubuntu. I'm sorry, we will look for other default file handlers on Ubuntu, which may be vulnerable to exploitation. I'm not, he writes, a binary exploitation guru like Chris. So instead, we'll try to find bugs which are exploitable without memory corruption. So again, you know, our systems are complex. We want them to do everything. And there is legacy code that predates, in many cases, there's legacy code that predates our manic concern over security. But even since then, mistakes get made. So the new cycle here is, as we've been discussing recently, is that problems are found, they're responsibly disclosed, they're fixed in a timely fashion, and hopefully, as we move forward with a heightened appreciation for security, we'll be making fewer mistakes than we fix. So the count of unknown vulnerabilities drops over time. And ultimately, I think we just need to scrap this entire model. You know, everything we're doing is like the way firewalls used to be, of permit all and block known problems. It was easy to flip the firewall model around. We're still using an architecture from the first computers with relays and tubes. Nothing has changed. Our systems are fundamentally exploitable because of the way they're designed. And I think we're getting to the point now where we have enough excess power. You know, this all comes from the fact that computers have never been able to be as fast as we needed them to be. So we just did a the fastest possible solution, having them operate in a way which is fundamentally secure rather than fundamentally insecure, they will not be nearly as efficient, but they will be potentially bug-free, that is, in terms of this kind of exploit. I know there's like research in labs going on now saying we just have to scrap everything we have. It's gotten us to this point, but it's just really becoming a problem. So, and we learned also, just to sort of share the wealth, that last week's patch of Apple's Mac OS X closed a problem that we've discussed for years. In this case, with the fact that Thunderbolt gave external peripherals that were attached to the Macs DMA access. After the patch was in place last Thursday, the guy who figured this out told us what he had found. He wrote, Mac OS File Vault 2 let attackers with physical access retrieve the password in clear text by plugging he quotes a $300, but it certainly didn't, I mean, just because it was available for $300, Thunderbolt device into a locked or sleeping Mac. The password may be used to then unlock the Mac to access everything on it. To secure your Mac, he writes, just update it with the December 2016 patches. Until then, anyone, including but not limited to your colleagues, the police, the evil maid, and the thief, will have full access to your data as long as they can gain physical access, unless the Mac is completely shut down. If it's sleeping, it is still vulnerable. So he poses the question in his coverage, how is this possible? He writes, at the very core of this issue, there are two separate issues. The first is that the Mac does not protect itself against direct memory access attacks before Mac OS is started. The EFI BIOS, which is running at this early stage, enables Thunderbolt, allowing malicious devices to read and write memory directly. At this stage, Mac OS is not yet started, but it resides on the encrypted disk, which must be unlocked before it can be started. Once Mac OS is started, it will enable DMA protections by default. So the point is there's a little window of opportunity after the motherboard BIOS boots, which by default enables the Thunderbolt hardware interface, and until the Mac OS has booted, which is then able to apply the DMA memory restrictions that we've talked about in the past as a means of thwarting this kind of DMA access. There's a little window there, a gap. The second issue, he writes, is that the File Vault password is stored in clear text in memory, and it's not automatically scrubbed from memory once the disk is unlocked. The password is put in multiple memory locations, which all appear to move around between reboots, but remain within a fixed memory range, obviously making it that range searchable. This makes it easy to just plug in the DMA attack hardware and reboot the Mac. Because the reboot doesn't wash away what's in RAM. So the reboot then allows that window to give the plugged-in device access before Mac OS starts to restrict its access, but while the previous content of RAM is still present. So he says, Once the Mac is rebooted, the DMA protections that macOS previously enabled are dropped. The memory contents, including the password, is still there, though. There is a time window of a few seconds before the memory containing the password is overwritten with new content. So this was responsibly disclosed. Back last summer, at the end of July, the issue was discovered. At DEF CON 24 in early August, on the 5th of August, PCI Leech is what the hardware was called, was presented. But although known, the file vault issue was not mentioned. 10 days later, Apple was notified. The day after that, on August 16th, Apple confirmed the issue and asked to hold off on disclosure. And then on the 13th, 1 week ago, Apple released Mac OS 10.12.2, which contains a security update. And he verified that it worked on his MacBook Air. And then his conclusion gives props to Apple. He wrote, "The solution Apple decided upon and rolled out is a complete one, at least to the extent that I've been able to confirm. It is no longer possible to access memory prior to Mac OS boot. The Mac is now one of the most secure platforms with regard to this specific attack vector." So, as often, it's secure now. It wasn't before, but it got responsibly handled. Apple got the fix in place, and something that could have been done just with a physical hardware device that was able to rapidly scan memory, find the plain text password that had been left in memory after the machine had been suspended or put to sleep. We learned also more details about the steganography. There's widespread agreement that I made up the term steganometry.
Oh, too bad. I liked it.
Well, that means measuring steganography.
Yeah, steganometry. There you go. See? Yeah.
How big is your steganography? Yeah. Well, that would be steganometry. Yeah. So we learned more about what's going on, and it's chilling, so I wanted to share it. A security firm, Proofpoint, has dug way into this. And in fact, there's a graphic on their site, Leo, you might want to bring up just because it's sobering in terms of the sophistication of this attack. And it's sobering because it demonstrates to what lengths bad guys are willing to go in order to get what they want. And so it just sort of says, you know, this is not the script kiddie anymore. Yes, you know, so you're now showing the graphic of the back and forth protocol that this attack uses in order to achieve its ends.
It's so complex, I can't fit it all on the screen.
I know. Proofpoint researchers have reported frequently this year, they write, on the decline in exploit kit activity, or they call them EKs. So they say EKs, though, are still vital components of malvertising operations, exposing large numbers of users, and we're talking millions, to malware via malicious ads. Since the end of October, they write, we have seen an improved version of the DNS changer exploit kit used in ongoing malvertising campaigns. DNS changer attacks internet routers via potential victims' web browsers. Okay, so think about that. DNS changer attacks internet route, meaning local, the user's routers, their LAN routers, their own net routers, via potential victims' web browsers. The exploit kit does not rely on browser or device vulnerabilities, but rather vulnerabilities in the victim's home or small office routers. Most often, DNS changer works through the Chrome browser. And of course, we now know that's the majority browser on the internet. So yeah, if it's not multi-browser, you're going to choose Chrome on Windows desktops and Android devices. However, once routers are compromised, all users, remember, because this is changing the DNS, which all devices on the LAN will then use, which is why this is such a devastating attack. All users connecting to the router, regardless of their operating system or browser, are then vulnerable to attack and further malvertising. The router attacks appear to happen in waves that are likely associated with ongoing malvertising campaigns lasting several days. Attack pattern and infection chain similarities led us to conclude, they write, that the actor behind these campaigns was also responsible for the CSRF, the cross-site request forgery, SOHO farming operations in the latter half, or I'm sorry, in the first half of 2015. They write, however, we uncovered several improvements in the implementation of these attacks, including external DNS resolution for internal addresses, steganography to conceal an AES key used to decrypt the list of fingerprints. These are router fingerprints, the default credentials, and local resolutions. The layout for the commands sent to attack the targeted routers. And get this, the addition of dozens of recent router exploits. There are now 166 fingerprints that this thing recognizes, some working for several router models versus a year ago, 55 fingerprints. They say, for example, some like the exploit targeting the Comtrend ADSL router were a few weeks old, dated September 13th, when the attacker began around October 28th, meaning that there are resources being put into this. The moment a new local router vulnerability is found, remember, this is not a remote vulnerability. This is inside your network because you've got routers typically with web interfaces that allow you to log on to them. This thing figures out which router you've got with 166 different fingerprints and knows the default credentials for logging on to those routers and then does so. It says, when possible, in 36 cases, the exploit kit modifies the router's network rules to make the admin ports available from external addresses. So it's opening incoming connectivity to your router. They write, exposing the router to additional attacks like those perpetrated by the Mirai botnets. And the malvertising chain is now accepting Android devices as well. So this is what we're up against. Innocent people using Chrome on Windows or, of course, the default browser, Chrome on Android, just visit a reputable page and their browser receives malvertising, which is all that's necessary to commandeer the Chrome browser and this is using AES encryption with dynamically varying keys. So the content was encrypted under the key, which is steganographically hidden in the ad's image. The script that's part of the ad runs in Chrome. parses the least significant bits out of the image to extract the AES key, uses that to decrypt a blob, which looks like random noise, so it doesn't get caught by any advertising blocking anywhere. That then decrypts the code necessary to cause the JavaScript running in the browser to be able to then perform a series of local queries to your router, checking its fingerprints to identify it, and then selecting specific router-specific code to access the router, change DNS. So now instead of your ISP's DNS or Open or Google or wherever you're, you know, like real DNS, you then, without knowing it, your DNS gets changed so that all the devices in your network are now obtaining DNS services from a bad guy. And as we know, DNS security is lagging behind. We spent a lot of time on the podcast talking about how important it is that it be secure. It's, however, lagging behind. And that means that anything you do in your network for as long as this change persists will be looking up IP addresses from illegitimate DNS servers, any of which can then be used to point somewhere else. And of course, what that means is your browser actually thinks you are at https://amazon.com, but you're at a site pretending to be that. And unfortunately, that then allows them to grab the cookies that your browser provides with its very first query to that site, thinking that it's actually at Amazon, but it's not Amazon picking up your cookies and, you know, and your authentication at that site. And it just goes from there. So, wow. Again, complexity. We have built an incredibly complex system where by leveraging individual features, each individually, which seem benign, when you put them together in a clever fashion, you can pretty much do whatever you want to. And unfortunately, these guys have watched millions of people being subjected to this, and some subset of them being vulnerable. So if nothing else, you may think, I do not need to change the login for my router, because it's I'm sure I've blocked it from the outside. Only people on the inside can get it. You know, don't leave it set to admin and password as your username and password, or admin and admin, or whatever it is. It's worth making sure that something that might operate in your machine is unable to get to your router. Yikes. And in something not security related, the National Highway Traffic Safety Administration has published a notice of proposed rulemaking. It is 392 pages. So I'm not going to go through it. The table of contents, though, was interesting to browse through. This proposed rulemaking will be mandating vehicle to vehicle. So we will have a new acronym, V2V, communication systems in all new cars and trucks. Once the rule is finalized, car makers will have 2 model years to begin including V2V systems with a bit of slack to allow the synchronization of product cycles. V2V equipped cars will communicate with each other at short ranges. I think I remember seeing up to 300 meters to prevent the kinds of accidents where current advanced driver assistance systems, most of which depend upon line of sight, are not effective. V2V, for example, a car might be broadcasting, I'm stalled. And when you get within range of that, that would heighten the awareness or alertness, maybe of the of a human driver or of the auto driving software, which is approaching the stalled vehicle. V2V and related vehicle infrastructure, another one, vehicle to infrastructure, that's V2I, and they're referring there to things like stoplights. Apparently, we're going to be talking to stoplights before long, too. Relies on that what's known as the dedicated short-range radio communication, DSRC, wireless protocol to communicate between devices at ranges, oh yeah, here it is, of up to 984 feet, which is an odd-looking number because it's actually 300 meters. Vehicles will send out standardized basic safety messages that trigger driver alerts or even emergency avoidance actions to prevent crashes. And of course, under the topic of what could possibly go wrong, you know, what we're doing is we are escalating the level of technology with the best of intentions. Merry Christmas. So ours in their coverage writes, recognizing the immense implications of an insecure protocol, the notice asks industry and the public for input on the proposed security specifications and proposes that, quote, vehicles contain firewalls. Of course, they don't know what that means. Between V2V modules and other vehicle modules connected to the data bus to help isolate V2V modules being used as a potential conduit into other vehicle systems, which, of course, happens all the time, unfortunately. Privacy is also given due attention. How nice. And the proposed rule would prevent cars from sending out identifiable data like a vehicle's VIN number or a driver's name or address. Well, how again, thoughtful that your car is not going to be announcing who you are as you're driving along. So, oh, goodness. This podcast will never end, Leo. We will have fodder from now. I mean, we keep doing this. We have IoT. Now we're going to have the IoT of vehicles called V2V. Notice there's no S in V2V either, just like there's no S for security in IoT. Wow. And then in something that I thought you would find interesting, Leo, the news is photographers and filmmakers are calling for encryption to be built natively into cameras as a standard feature.
I don't get that. Explain.
Here it comes. Over 150 filmmakers and photojournalists are calling on major camera manufacturers to build encryption into their cameras. Last Wednesday, Trevor Tim, the executive director of the Freedom of the Press Foundation, wrote, "Today, Freedom of the Press Foundation is publishing an open letter to the world's leading camera manufacturers, including Nikon, Sony, Canon, Olympus, and Fuji, urging them to build encryption into their still photo and video cameras to help protect the filmmakers and photojournalists who use them." The letter has been signed. And by the way, Leo, you ought to pull up the letter. It's the second link here on the page. It's a documentcloud.org letter that shows the signatories to this. The letter is signed by over 150 documentary filmmakers and photojournalists from around the world, including 15 Academy Award nominees and writers, including Laura Poitras, Alex Gibney, Joshua Oppenheimer, and many more. Documentary filmmakers, they write, and photojournalists work in some of the most dangerous parts of the world, often risking their lives to get footage of newsworthy events to the public. They face a variety of threats from border security guards, local police, intelligence agents, terrorists, and criminals when attempting to safely return their footage so it can be edited and published. These threats are particularly heightened any time a bad actor can seize or steal their camera. And they're
like Nicolas Cage? He's a terrible actor. Oh, no. Oh, I know what you mean. Bad guys. Although bad actors might want to seize the footage, too. Yeah, I don't know.
Bad actors may want to lose the key. They're left unprotected by the lack of security features that would shield their footage from prying eyes. The magnitude of this problem is hard to overstate. Filmmakers and photojournalists have their cameras and footage seized as a rate that is, they write, literally too high to count. Although we do have high numbers. Anyway, the committee...
It sounds like it's infinity.
You know, well, crypto, those are big numbers. We recite those routinely. The Committee to Protect Journalists, a leading organization that documents many such incidents, told us, quote, "Confiscating the cameras of photojournalists is a blatant attempt to silence and intimidate them, yet such attacks are so common that we could not realistically track all of the incidents. The unfortunate truth is that photojournalists are regularly targeted and threatened as they seek to document and bear witness, but there is little they can do to protect their equipment and their photos. Camera manufacturers are behind the times compared to other technology companies. All iPhones and many Android phones come with encryption built into their devices. Communication services like Apple's iMessage and FaceTime plus Facebook's WhatsApp encrypt text messages and calls by default. And many major operating systems on PCs and Macs give users the ability to encrypt the hard drives on their computers. Yet, footage stored on the professional cameras most commonly used today are still left dangerously vulnerable. Finding the right way to provide encryption in their products will take some research and development from these camera manufacturers. And we welcome having a conversation with Nikon, Sony, Canon, and others about a best move forward on this important initiative. However, we're hopeful they will publicly respond with a commitment to building encryption into their products to protect many of their most valuable customers." And of course, we can see where this is going to go. The instant one of them does, they all must follow, because this is obviously an important need and issue for that segment of their cameras purchasers, and they're going to have that bullet point, you know, native military grade encryption, blah, 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 which will soon become, I expect we will see, a standard feature in high-end professional cameras. I thought that was really interesting. I hadn't thought about that.
Yeah, I hadn't either. Yeah. It makes sense, though. Yeah.
Yeah, totally.
Yep.
So there is a service that I would argue our listeners, if you need it, it's nice on its face, but unfortunately, to make it maximally available, they have sacrificed some security in some worrisome fashion. What this is, it's a web-based front end to the Let's Encrypt service. It's called SSLforfree.com. Amazing that domain wasn't used before now. SSLforfree.com. SSL for free. So under their how it works, they say, "We generate certificates using the Let's Encrypt ACME server by using domain validation. Private keys are generated in your browser," okay? There's problem number one, "and never transmitted." Well, it's good they're never transmitted. Browsers are just not a place you want a private key for your web server to ever be resident. But they say for modern browsers, "We generate a private key in your browser using the web cryptography API. And the private key is never transmitted. The private key also gets deleted from your browser after the certificate is generated." Well, how nice. But then they say, if your browser does not support the web cryptography API, then the keys will be generated. They're talking about the private key for your web server will be generated on our server using the latest version, okay, good, of OpenSSL and outputted over SSL, good, and never stored, good. But, you know, you don't ever want your server's private key to ever go anywhere, really preferably never outside of your server. And that's the way it's being done now. Your private key never leaves the server that generated it. Now they're saying, oh, yeah, you know, maybe your browser can generate the private key. If not, we'll happily do it for you and then send it to you. Hand it, you know, with the Let's Encrypt Acme server. Yikes. Then they end saying, for the best security, you are recommended to use a supported browser for your client. You can also provide your own CSR, that's a certificate signing request, when using manual verification, in which case the private key is handled completely on your end. Okay, so from all of this, if there's anyone out there who wants a Let's Encrypt key or a Let's Encrypt cert, then you should definitely generate the private key the old-fashioned way. If you've got a web server that supports HTTPS connections, it has the ability. I mean, it's probably got OpenSSL or it's a Windows machine, so it's got the crypto API in it. They all can generate the private key for you. Do it on that server. Then what that generates is a certificate signing request. Then you could use that safely because it does not have your private key in it. It's you are asking them to sign the matching public key. So that you put in to SSL for free. They do the interaction with the Let's Encrypt server and send and give you back a certificate for that is the signed public key for your server's private key that never left the boundary of your server. So, I mean, it's nice that these guys are like bending over backward to solve the problem, but they're doing so in a frightening fashion. You know, we know SSL. We wish it were secure. It's not. You're using web HTTP connections to move this stuff back and forth. We just talked about DNS changer, so you don't even know if you're actually connecting to them or to someone spoofing them. So again, there are too many holes in this Swiss cheese that we are currently operating in for that to be secure. There's an interesting site I have in the show notes that I didn't want to skip. He calls it Robin Linus, RobinLinus.com. And the service is WebK, WebKay. So if you go to, and it's a little unnerving, WebKay.RobinLinus, RobinLinus.com, what you are presented with is a page of what your browser knows about you. Now, we've sort of seen these things before, but maybe not for a year, where we were looking at like all the junk in the query headers and stuff. This shows the geolocation of like where you're located, what OS you're using, a bunch of stuff that's familiar, but it's just sort of it's a convenient reminder of any site you go to. Every place you go, just like this one, the amount of data that your browser and our state-of-the-art technologies. I mean, you'll notice there's battery in there. He says that my computer is currently charging its battery. It's like, okay. But the point is, there's an API in the browser that, you know, tries to report on the state of your battery. And as we know, that because of the resolution of some of those parameters, that can be used to track you. So just sort of a worthwhile reminder. Also, Google Contributor is being terminated. Apparently it's going to get reborn. Oh, I know.
I am.
In fact, what's so funny, Leo, is yesterday when I was researching this, I was looking at a web page covered with Google contributor blanked out ads.
Yeah.
So I thought, well, isn't that ironic? You know, there was a big banner at the top and a bunch of little squares floating around with those sort of those little pastel circles.
I see kitty cats.
Oh, you do?
Yeah. Well, that's, you can choose what you want to replace.
Okay.
Ads.
Yeah. I went with fuzzy floodlights.
It's probably smart. Yeah.
So email has been sent. I didn't get mine yet. Maybe it's probably went to my Gmail account, which is, you know, my slop account. Email being received reads, "Thank you for being part of Google Contributor, a service that helps readers enjoy fewer ads while funding the sites they love. Early next year, we are launching a new and improved contributor."
Oh, good. Okay.
Yeah. "Your input throughout the testing has been invaluable." Okay, I didn't give any input, but I gave them a lot of money.
Yeah.
"As we build this new service, we will discontinue the current version of Contributor. What this means to you, starting in mid-January 2017, so like 3 weeks from now, 4 weeks, you will no longer see Contributor ad replacements as you browse the web." So they're shutting it down. "And you will be unable to access your Contributor account." They're closing that down. "You will no longer be billed," well, thank you, "for the non-functioning Contributor service starting mid-January 2017. And we will refund your remaining account balance to your credit or debit card on file." That's all they say. Now, they don't give a commitment to a start date. They're not telling us when they're going to replace it or when the new service will be coming up. But there is a link to a Google Docs form, which you can fill out, and I did, and I've got the link in the show notes, to register yourself for notification when they relaunch the service. And boy, I tell you, I mean, I see so many of those little contributor boxes when I'm surfing the net, of which I'm happy to pay pennies for instead of either blocking the ads or having to put up with ads or the malvertising that they're replacing, that I'm happy to do that. Also, I did want to mention the PF Sense people have a beautiful little cute 2-port PF Sense hardware security gateway. It's the SG-1000.
They named it after you.
They did. It wasn't that thoughtful. I think it actually stands for Security Gateway, but I'm happy to go with Steve Gibson. It's like the size of a Arduino or a Raspberry Pi. It's just a cute little thing. It's got, you know, a WAN and a LAN port and power. Just adorable. And I forgot to say, it's $150. So it is the low end of their range. Now, what it does not have is more ports. And that's the nice thing about the $49 switch, which also has a lot of security features that allows for physical network segmentation. However, this is full PF Sense. And that's on top of nano BSD with the kitchen sink and, you know, 5 bathtubs in there. I mean, open VPN, you can run reverse proxies, it's got everything. So what you could do, because it also supports VLAN, if you put a VLAN aware switch downstream that is connect the its VLAN port to a VLAN aware switch, and those are, you know, cheap, those are $20-$30, then that would get that the switch would enforce network segmentation with its multiple ports, so that this cute little Fire Engine Red security appliance does not need more than just its 2 ports. So I wanted to put it on everybody's radar. I mean, because it doesn't get any nicer than PF Sense from a standpoint of a massively feature-rich solution. we have some errata. I misspoke last week because, in my defense, my brain cannot believe, it cannot process the reality of the truth of this. I said that IPv6 subscribers get 64K IPs. Wow! 64,000. Actually, we know it's 65536 IPs. It's essentially a, what would that be? A 16-bit network block.
Uh-uh.
No. They get 64, not K IPs, 64 bits.
Wow.
Of IPs. Okay, now, okay. Remember that 32 bits is the entire internet currently. The entire IPv4 internet is 32. And remember, 64 is double the bits, but it's not double the internet. It's the internet squared. It's every single IP on the internet is an internet itself. So it's, I don't even know how to pronounce this number. 1-844-6-744-073-709-551-616. That's how many IPs we each get. You, Leo, get that many. I get that many. Actually, that's not even true. The recommendation is that rather than a slash 64, maybe give them a, you know, maybe give them even more. Shorten the so-called prefix. Okay, so here's what's going on. The IP space in IPv6 is 128 bits. And they decided, we got so many bits now, we're just going to slice it in half.
Wow.
There's going to be 64 bits on the left and 64 bits on the right.
It's 18 quintillion, 446 quadrillion, 744 trillion, 73 billion, 799 million, 551,616.
Light bulbs. That's how many light bulbs you can have.
Holy I'm ready. Crap. My Internet of Things is going crazy.
Yes,
18 and a half quintillion.
Light bulbs. Okay, so I'm thinking, okay, this cannot be right. This is nuts. So I go to RFC 3177. Introduction. It's very staid, of course, when you're writing your RFC. There have been, they write, many discussions between the IETF and RIR experts on the topic of IPv6 address allocation policy. Yeah, because, you know, we got more bits than we could ever possibly. So we got them to burn. This memo addresses the issue of the boundary in between the public and private topology of the internet. That is, how much address space should an ISP allocate to homes, small and large enterprises, mobile networks, and transient customers? And they say the background, and we're running out of time, so I'll make this quick. The technical principles that apply to address allocation seek to balance healthy conservation practices, okay, I don't see any sign of that, and wisdom or that, with a certain ease of access. On one hand, when managing a potentially limited resources, one must conserve wisely to prevent exhaustion within an expected lifetime, yeah, of the universe. On the other hand, the IPv6 address space is in no sense as limited a resource as the IPv4 address space. And unwarranted conservatism acts as a we don't have to worry about that being applied here, acts as a disincentive in a marketplace already dampened by other factors. So, from a market development perspective, we would like to see it be very easy for a user or an ISP to obtain as many IPv6 addresses as they really need without a prospect of immediate renumbering or of scaling inefficiencies. The IP
No one could ever need more than 18 and a half quintillion IP addresses.
Oh, Leo. The IPv6 address, as currently defined, consists of, get this, 64 bits of network number. That is the high left hand 64 bits identify your network. That is, you know, this is you. That's the public IP, essentially, on the internet. We used to have 32. Now we have 64. So there's also 18 and a half quintillion individual networks. And they write 64 bits of host number. That is light bulbs. The technical reasons for this are several. And then they go into it. So they're just going to split the 128 bits in half. Everybody gets their own internet squared in their house. And in fact, it's even worse. I won't go into it any further, but that is absolutely is the case. They say they're suggesting in the general case, maybe even give them someone might need multiple internet squared 18 and a half quintillion networks. So, you know, well, why not? We don't want to be bothered with anybody running out of anything ever again. And we run out of time, not IP addresses, but time. I did want to acknowledge, as I did earlier, the steganometry apparently is a word I've invented for the measurement of steganography, which is the actual word. I did misspeak and talk about I was talking about a high numbered port, and I said 123.123. Sharp observers noted that, well, Steve, 123.123 is a little bigger than 65535, so you would need an extra bit of port numbering for that. And I, so of course, yes, I meant 123.12. Doesn't sound quite as nice, but anyway, so thank you. And somebody who liked our 73 map of the internet had a 1973 map, had a 1977. I've now given these links permanent residence on the link farm, so you can find them, and it's in the show notes. But so this shows 4 years later how the ARPANET has grown, and it's interesting. It's maybe twice the size, so we're not going exponential yet. But it's a nice – oh, and there is a key on this map verifying that the squiggly line is a satellite link out to Hawaii. Ah. And it's also some called Norsar or SAC or something. I don't know. Anyway, so there is that map. And I had a little spin right note about cabling errors, but we'll do that in 2 weeks.
And you also have to tell us
– oh, about the robot.
About the robot capture.
We'll start with that 2 weeks from now. For those who haven't already heard it, next week we're going to play the infamous or famous portable dog killer episode. I guarantee you, I've never heard Leo laugh so long and hard as I was.
There's no video of this, though, right? It's just audio.
Well, we did a video.
Is there a video? Oh, good. Okay. All right. Good.
Yeah, it is a video. So I think everybody will get a kick out of it. You may have forgotten it. You may, if you've got
some
family around for the holidays. Yeah. And it had a moral also about sort of an unintended consequences moral. So I think everybody will enjoy it. We'll see you next year.
Tonight is the darkest night since 1648 or something like that.
Well,
tonight is winter solstice. You know, the longest night of the year tonight.
The shortest day, right.
Yeah, shortest day, longest night. And there is a total lunar eclipse. And there hasn't been a total lunar eclipse on winter solstice for almost 500 years.
Cool.
So the moon will go out. You can look at the stars.
Completely blocked by the Earth.
Blocked by the Earth. It will be very cool. It's from 2:41 to 3:53 a.m. Eastern time for totality. But at midnight our time, 11:41 p.m.
Oh,
our time.
Oh, yeah, yeah, okay. Good.
So that means midnight should be very interesting in your neck of the woods. And happy winter solstice to you, Steve. And have a wonderful holiday, and we'll see you in the new year.
Indeed, my friend, and I'll shoot you an email in a couple of days and with some update stuff.
We'll converse.
Yes.
Via the internet. Steve Gibson does this show every Tuesday, 1:30 Pacific, 4:30 Eastern, 21:30 UTC. So do tune in if you want to watch it live. Join us in the chat room at irc.twit.tv or join us in studios. Nina and Alexandra did. You just email tickets at twit.tv. We'd love to have you in here. But if you can't do any of that, you can get on-demand versions at grc.com. Steve's site, he has audio plus transcripts, nice transcripts of every episode. Makes it easy to search for something you're looking for at grc.com. He also has other stuff there while you're there. Get Spinrite, the world's best hard drive maintenance and recovery utility, even for SSDs. You can also find Perfect Paper Passwords and Spinrite and all the other great stuff Steve does. Now, if you want to get video, you need to go to our site, twit.tv/SN. We have audio and video. And, of course, you can always subscribe, and that way you won't miss an episode. You don't want to miss an episode. This is a good show. You learn a lot in this show. It's a lot of fun. Somebody said, it's not a full moon tonight, it's a full Earth. I like it. thank you so much, Steve. Thank you, everybody. Happy New Year. Merry Christmas. Next week, the portable dog killer. And we'll see you January 3rd right here for a brand new Security Now.
Cool. Thanks, Leo.